KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the world premiere of Jump, co-produced by Confrontation Theater and the Milagro Theater. The play runs from March 21st through April 13th at the Milagro Theater in Portland. Jump is the story of a 20-something who is reeling from the death of her mother. She is looking for solace in a good place to vape, but what she finds is a journey of self-discovery. Again, that's Jump. Every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday from March 21st through April 13th at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello! This is Susan Cecil, and I love KBOO. Do you love KBOO? Call us at 503-231-8032, extension 302, and tell us why you love KBOO. We'll use the audio during our upcoming spring membership drive. It takes the community to support the community radio station, KBOO! Yay! The number again, 503-231-8032, extension 302. This has been Susan Cecil for KBOO Portland, signing out. Bye!
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Time is a little after 11 o'clock. The food show is coming up right now.
Made you a present you never expected.
What they are, why people love them, and how they're impacting Portland's food scene. I'm Emily Becker, and I'm here with Tal Cosby. Tal, you are really excited about talking about pop-ups on this month's show. Why?
Well, I actually started my restaurant with a pop-up, so this is something that I experienced myself, and I think people should know more about it.
What was it like to run a pop-up?
It was semi-painful, fun, hectic, chaotic. But it's definitely a learning experience.
Awesome. When you first brought up the topic of having it be about topics, I wasn't really sure what I thought about them. I haven't really gone to many, and I just kind of had this image of like a rock star celebrity chef coming to Portland and like dropping in, doing a big event where you like had to get on some secret list to get in, and then it's a really expensive thing, which is just like not my scene at all. But then I started thinking more about it and how it's like really interesting in so many different ways. Like, I think that pop-ups are interesting because they make use of underutilized spaces. They're often in places that aren't always restaurants, or that are sometimes that are restaurants, but then in their off hours. And then I also like how, you know, without the overhead costs of a brick and mortar restaurant or even a food truck, it seems like it's a really low barrier to entry into the food world, which maybe means there's like more diverse people who are making food. And so I think it's just like pretty cool.
Yeah, I think we're going to find out all about it today.
Awesome. Yeah, we've got a lot to talk about. Today, we're talking to four different chefs who do all sorts of different pop-ups. And at the end of the show, we'll talk a little bit about spring gardening. First, we're going to talk to Michael Russell. Michael has like everyone's dream job. He is the Oregonian's restaurant reporter and critic. And besides telling us what are the best places to eat, he also tracks what's happening in Portland's food scene. Michael's joining us by phone. Welcome, Michael.
Hi, guys. Yeah, it's getting harder and harder to track what's going on in Portland's restaurant scene. It just seems like there's a new pop-up almost every day you have to keep an eye on.
Can you actually tell our listeners what a pop-up is?
Right. So, you know, it's kind of an umbrella term that encapsulates a lot of different styles of sort of temporary restaurants. I would think of it like the most pure example of a pop-up. Like there's a restaurant on your in your neighborhood that serves burgers, and one night a week a different chef comes in and serves something totally different using the same kitchen. Maybe it becomes a ramen shop or something like that for one night a week. But in practice, we've sort of stretched that term out like mozzarella cheese a little too far. And the term kind of now incorporates things like maybe a chef does a special, you know, dumpling tasting menu one night a week at their own restaurant. Some people kind of complain, well, that's not really a pop-up, that's just a special. But I think it's kind of both and everything right now.
Do you have any history on pop-ups, like where they started?
Well, you know, in Portland, we sort of trace the evolution of the pop-up to a couple of really influential moments in the mid-2000s. The first one was a chef named Naomi Pomeroy and her partner at the time, Michael Hebb, eventually started a restaurant group called Ripe. And before that group started, they were doing really casual supper clubs, you know, sometimes at their own home for guests, like 10 to 20 guests. And out of those supper clubs, you got like three or four restaurants in the Ripe group. And chefs who worked for some of those restaurants went on to open some of Portland's best restaurants. So we're talking about Gabriel Rucker worked for Naomi and went on to open Le Pigeon, which is one of the best fine dining restaurants in Portland. Tommy Habits worked there. He goes on to open Bunk Sandwiches, which is one of our most popular sandwich shops. And the list kind of goes on and on. At the same time, there was a venue called the Simpatica Cafe inside the old La Luna theater space, which was an old rock club. And the guys there were doing sort of like changing dinners where it would be Spanish one night and Italian the next night, et cetera, et cetera. And like one of those nights, a Spanish night, went on to become the restaurant Toro Bravo in Northeast Portland. And the guys who were left at Simpatica Cafe ended up opening like a dozen restaurants, maybe not quite that many, but they opened Laurelhurst Steakhouse, Laurelhurst Market Steakhouse, 808, the Hawaiian restaurant, Reverend's Barbecue in Selwood, and on and on and on. So I think locally you can kind of trace it back to those two pop-ups in around 2004 to 2006. I think some people credit in America, they credit the first pop-up to a chef named Ludo Lefebvre, who did a pop-up in Los Angeles, and he's gone on to become kind of a celebrity chef. But locally, I would say it's Naomi Pop's thing on one hand and then Simpatica Cafe on the other, Simpatica Catering.
That's awesome. So I'm really interested in how pop-ups are, I don't know, they seem like a really good way for chefs without a lot of capital to start out, or even maybe like a lot of experience. And it seems like to open a brick and mortar restaurant or even a food truck, it requires a lot of money and investment and time. But a pop-up removes some of those barriers. And I'm kind of wondering if that also means that pop-ups themselves and the people that are running them are more diverse than other types of food spaces in Portland. Have you noticed anything about that?
I think there's some element of that. I find that in practice, the way the thing that pop-ups seem to be the thing that pop-ups are best at in Portland is they Portland doesn't really have a really big fine dining scene, and part of that is because the city of Portland just doesn't have like a huge amount of giant corporations the way Seattle has Microsoft and Amazon, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we have Nike and Beaverton, but we don't have this like base of really wealthy diners who go out to eat at super, you know, high-end fine dining restaurants. So a lot of the chefs who do pop-ups are chefs who have trained at really high-end restaurants and they're coming back and they're offering a sort of really high level of dining experience that might cost $90 or $120 or $150 a person that, you know, for whatever reason, they don't think the economics of that can work for, you know, a full restaurant, even if it were only operating 4 days a week. They just don't think they can bring the customer base in. We've also seen pop-ups that are exploring Filipino food and sort of modern Mexican food and some things that maybe aren't super represented in Portland, and the chefs behind those restaurants have been maybe more diverse than your average, you know, white bearded guy, celebrity chef who, you know, is fronting whatever restaurant you've heard about in the local city magazine. But I think that they, or read about in Oregonian for that matter, it is adding a little bit of diversity, but I think that what they seem to be best at, or at least what the chefs are most interested in, is offering a sort of level of fine dining and service, which could include it being a Mexican restaurant or a Filipino restaurant, that is difficult to just have a full restaurant, at least for a day.
Oh, Michael, it sounds like you're breaking up a little bit. Are you there?
Can you hear me?
Oh, okay, yeah, there that's good. Yeah. Cool.
Well, it sounds like pop-ups have had a huge influence on the Portland food scene.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, you know, that mid-2000s pop-up, that sort of uprising of pop-ups, that was followed in the mid-2010s by, like, a second rise of pop-ups. And, like, maybe most notable among those is a restaurant called Langban, which is a sort of chef's counter tasting menu Thai restaurant run by a guy named Earl Ninsum, who also runs a restaurant called Pa Di. He opens Langban. It literally means back of the house in Thai. So he opens this restaurant in the back of Pa Di, which is a fun street food kind of, Bangkok inspired Thai restaurant. And Langban is like this fantastic, you know, extremely elevated Thai food that is actually not just hard to find in Portland, it's really hard to find anywhere in America. And, I think he opened that in 2004. And at the same time, it was like you travel around the city any night of the week and find cool restaurants that were in people's garages or, you know, back alleyways or upstairs. And like, it was a really fun moment in Portland's restaurant scene. And it's continued to some extent to today.
Cool. So Michael, I don't know if you know this about us or the food show, but we really like to talk about labor and the people who grow and cook and serve our food. So I'm just wondering if there's, you know, anything around labor or the kinds of food people are, or like where people are buying food that are different about pop-ups than other kinds of restaurants.
Well, there are two kind of interesting restaurants that might be worth talking about, not on the labor side, but in terms of sort of sustainability. I'm not sure if that's interesting to you guys too, but there's a restaurant, but it looks a little like a pop-up in that it's a chef's counter. It's called Erizo, E-R-I-Z-O. It's also in the La Luna Theater building down on, I believe, like 9th, just below Sandy. And they're all about sustainable seafood, sustainable beef. Them and another pop-up called Pasture, which just started off in the Northeast Portland Wine Bar Dame. They're both using like retired dairy cows to provide the beef for whatever they're serving, whether that's a hamburger or a steak or whatever. So they're using a cow that would probably ordinarily just, you know, be put to slaughter or whatever to serve food to people. And I think that's a really cool thing that's going on right now.
And is that something that like a restaurant wouldn't be able to do because they wouldn't get enough quantity of meat, or, you know, like what's the difference with the pop-up?
That's a really good question. I think that it's like, you know, a part of it is introducing Portlanders or wherever the pop-up might be to things that they're not familiar with and might not be so likely to spend their money on, right? You know, right out of the gate. So if it's a pop-up, it feels like a special event. And you're like, well, I don't know that I would spend a lot of money to go to a corner steakhouse or bistro that's serving like old dairy cow meat. Like that doesn't sound great. But if it's like a one-time only special occasion pop-up, well, then it sounds a little appealing. And I think that's the case. Like someone might be willing to spend $90 on a tasting menu at one of these restaurants that they wouldn't necessarily be willing to spend at a pop-up, that they wouldn't necessarily be willing to spend at their corner neighborhood restaurant or whatever. The interesting thing from a labor perspective is a lot of these pop-ups operate on like extremely small staff. So you might have the same year that Longbon opened, a restaurant called Holdfast opened. That was also a pop-up, and they were like two guys, two highly trained chefs, and they were just like, we're doing everything. We're washing the dishes, we're serving all the food, you know, we're making, brewing the coffee for the end of the night. Like, it was like almost literally a two-man operation. It's since grown a little bit. But that like, from a labor perspective, is kind of interesting. Like, some of the pop-ups are exploring ways to trim the staff down to being as small as possible, which, you know, long-term, you know, we talk about, you know, labor issues. It's like, people have to have jobs, and if every restaurant is being operated with just two guys, like, that's a lot fewer jobs out there. So that could be a labor issue right there.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Michael. We're going to leave it there, and we're going to talk to some different folks who run pop-ups. Thanks for being on the show today.
Oh, great idea.
Thank you.
Thanks, you guys. Thanks for having me and letting me call in on my fussy connection here.
All right. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
We're joined now by Sean Sigmund, the chef behind the weekly brunch pop-up Folklore, and a close friend of mine, and almost co-worker. We've been working in the same building for many years, but never on the same project. Thank you for joining us, Sean.
Thank you for having me. Yeah.
So let's just start with you telling us about your culinary journey.
My journey? Yeah, the whole journey.
The whole thing.
I essentially grew up in restaurants. My parents were in the restaurant industry. They had a barbecue restaurant when I was 12 years old. So basically, I was child labor for them. I would get off of school, come, like, make coleslaw, make the barbecue sauce. So yeah, I grew up in it. I've worked in restaurants for my whole life. Try to cut out a couple times and do other jobs, but I end up finding myself back again. I've been vegetarian for over 25 years, vegan for many years. A lot of those years I was working in restaurants serving meats. And then I think about 15 years ago, I decided I wouldn't do that anymore. And I was only gonna like dedicate myself to like following my ethics and cooking completely vegan food. And I owned a cafe in Florida. I lived in Florida for many years, did pop-ups there, owned a cafe. And then I moved out here, was hired to open a restaurant called Harvest at the Bindery. So I was the opening chef of that place. And then, yeah, I worked at the Sudra after that. And I worked at Farm Spirit for a little while, and then back to Sudra. And at Sudra, I was a chef, head of operations there for about 2 years.
So your pop-up is called Folklore. How long have you been doing that?
I started Folklore last year. And last year, I think we did maybe six pop-ups, mainly kind of like sit-down, course-style, prefix meals, either in an event space or on farms. And then I started doing brunch last year also at a place called Blank Slate. And I'm doing that full-time this year. So I'm at Blank Slate like every Sunday doing brunch.
What's it like to transition from doing it, you know, occasionally to doing it every single week?
There's certainly a lot more pressure from doing it every week. My kind of like, I'm fully dedicated to it, so my life depends on it a little more. But it's awesome because I feel like it evolves a lot faster also. Mm-hmm. So just like recipes and ideals are coming faster because I'm there every week. I get a little more time meeting the customer because, like, I saw them just a week ago instead of maybe I saw them randomly at a farm like 6 months ago. So it definitely, for me, is helping me connect to the project more and kind of develop it. Yeah.
And what is your end goal with the pop-ups?
For Folklore, we're looking for a restaurant. I want a restaurant space in town, and I want a place that people can come. So we do more on the high end food. So I want to do like really nice food, the best food we can serve, but in a casual setting. Okay.
Sorry about that.
You got really serious there for a second.
In a casual setting. but in a casual setting, like a neighborhood like restaurant where people can come every night and eat.
And pop-ups, you're hoping will get you there?
Yeah, the pop-up basically is to A, let people in town know the food that I make, and kind of introduce myself to the people in Portland, and then also to attract a partner and an investor so that we can get into a restaurant space. Yeah.
Cool. So can you kind of walk us through how you make a pop-up work financially? I think people kind of get how a restaurant works, but how is a pop-up different? Like, how do you figure out labor costs and meal costs and ticket prices? And do people have to pay for the ticket like ahead of time so you have money to buy the food? Like, how do you work all that stuff out?
Yeah, I think a pop-up, for myself at least, it's a lot more, I mean, it's all out of pocket personally, and it's kind of the shoestring budget. And at the moment, it's kind of week to week. So everything I do comes from, all the food comes from the farmer's market. So essentially, I have to do well on Sunday to make money to do the next pop-up. And as far as labor and all that, it's, I think pop-ups are good because they give you the time to kind of figure out some of that stuff. Because right now, it's like myself, my girlfriend, and a friend or two that do the entire thing. Labor is very small, and myself and my girlfriend don't get paid, and we pay like one person. Mm-hmm. So it's good for us to have the opportunity to get food out there and to be doing this process. And there's not a lot of financial weight on our shoulders. Yeah.
So why do you love pop-ups?
It's an awesome experience in general. I think on our side, the people doing the pop-up, like you kind of mentioned before, it's a wild experience. Getting to the pop-up every week or like whenever you're doing it, you have to pull together all these, your equipment might be at your house, and then there's a restaurant you're prepping in, there's another restaurant or a random space, maybe in a basement somewhere, that you're going to serve the food. So it's a big challenge pulling it all together, and it's like kind of like a wild, fun ride every time. And then another good thing about it is the entry level is pretty small. Like, the bar is pretty small. Like, if you have food that you think is a good concept, and you can find a place that'll let you do it there, which is a difficulty, but if you can find someone to let you serve food, you're out in the public right away. Yeah.
Riding that adrenaline. Yeah.
Yeah.
Chefs do love that.
So where can people find out about your next events?
Yeah, so we are, you can go to folklorepdx.com. We're on Instagram at folklore_pdx, and then Facebook also, folklorepdx.
Awesome. And we've got links to everybody's restaurants and pop-ups on our page at kbu.fm. Awesome. Thank you, Sean. We're going to turn now to Paige Common. She's here in the studio. She owns a plant-based packaged foods company called Eaten Alive. She also does catering, and she hosts dinner party pop-ups called We Soiree. So, Paige, you've been running Eaten Alive for like 9 years now. What made you want to start doing pop-ups, and tell us all about We Soiree?
Yeah. So, hi everybody. I started Eaten Alive 9 years ago at the farmer's market on a bike, and the reason why I started Eaten Alive was because I saw that so many people needed quick, healthy food, and I really wanted to meet community. I wanted to get connected with farmers and makers. And over the years, now we've become more of a wholesale company, and I've kind of lost that connection with the community, and I wanted to get re-inspired and bring that back. So that's kind of the reason why I've started the pop-ups.
And what are the pop-ups like?
So I host pop-ups via Airbnb through the Airbnb experiences, and they're intimate dinner parties at my house. I invite usually about 3 Portland locals that are artists or food purveyors, farmers, and then 6 to 8 Airbnb guests come and they pay, and we have a really unique, interesting experience together.
What's it like to have a pop-up in your own personal home?
It's a lot of work. It's a vulnerable experience. You never know who's going to show up, and it's been really exciting though.
Are you doing all the cooking in your kitchen at home?
I prepare most of the food in our commercial kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I do it. So I think the whole like Airbnb and Feastly, like all the platforms that kind of exist now for pop-ups, are pretty interesting. It seemed like in the past you had to like follow somebody's social media accounts or get on their email list to get like to even possibly get a ticket to something like that. So like, what's it like using that platform, and you know, what's it like working with, you know, a bunch of people from out of town?
Yeah, it's been interesting. I think Airbnb provides a really great platform, so I don't really have to do much work getting people in the door. Mm-hmm. And then through that, then local Portland people contact me and have private experiences with me. So it's kind of opened a different door for me. But the reason why I started this was because when I've traveled, I've met random people on the street that have brought me into their home and prepared a traditional meal for me. And I feel like the experiences around the table are just so much more unique than going to a restaurant. And it's so easy to find secret spots, secret gems, using Google or Yelp. Mm-hmm. So I'm just trying to create something a little bit more intimate.
Awesome.
Besides the Airbnb events, what other kind of pop-ups do you have planned?
I'm in the, there are some summer and fall farm events in the works, but nothing planned yet.
Nothing on a schedule. Mm-hmm. So, like, I think that most pop-ups that I've heard about are, you know, much bigger than, like, 6 people. Like, what's it like, you know, making a menu for such a small group of people? And, like, you know, how do you get the food? And, like, what's your process to get all that set up?
Well, I try to highlight different food purveyors and some of my favorite farmers from the farmers markets. I usually use, it's all seasonal, and I use 2 of my favorite farms, which are Flying Coyote Farm and Vibrant Valley Farm, and then also Groundwork Organic. So usually I go to the farmers market, see what's in season, and then create something around that.
Awesome. One of the things that I'm kind of curious about pop-ups, I don't really know how to phrase this, but it's like when you have a restaurant and you're making the same set menu over and over and over, I assume you maybe would have a little bit less food waste than if you're like making a one-time menu and then you might not do it again for a week or a month or, you know, at least. So how do you deal with any kind of food waste issues or things that you have left over at the end?
I do a pretty good job with waste, but all of my employees at Eaten Alive get all of the leftovers.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, where can people find out about your events?
You can either email me at wesoiree@gmail.com, or you can go to Airbnb Experiences. And the Airbnb Experience is called Exclusive Dinner Party with the Locals.
Awesome. Well, we are going to take a really short break to bring in our next set of guests. Thanks so much for being here, Paige.
Thank you.
This is the Food Show, and today we're talking about pop-ups. Here in the studio, we have Uri Kushner, one half of Top Nosh. Uri and Farah are on a mission to bring New York bagels to Portland. Uri, what inspired you to start a bagel pop-up?
You know, it was really just looking for, you know, being a native New Yorker, but being out here for now several decades, you know, there's certain things that you miss, and you wonder if you're memories are accurate. You know, there's some things that, you know, kind of from the old world that we're looking to introduce, you know, kind of what's old is new again. And I know we have a number of, you know, wonderful local purveyors here, but it was really when we brought out some bagels from New York that are boiled and baked in New York, and then we're able to finish them off here fresh, that we were able to kind of notice the difference, and it really evoked, you know, kind of validated some of those feelings and memories that we had, that, hey, it is as good a product as we remember it from growing up. And so the opportunity to kind of rekindle similar feelings for some East Coast transplants here, as well as turn on some folks that maybe have never had the opportunity to try an authentic product like we're offering, it was really the driving force behind it.
So you guys haven't actually done a pop-up yet, which is so cool. Like, you're having your first one really soon, but what's it like to plan that very first event? You know, tell us about, like, how do you even go about figuring out those logistics?
You know, it's very, you know, fly by night. We're definitely trying to, you know, piece things together, but just constantly moving forward and making progress while we do it. You know, different than your earlier guests, you know, our pop-up isn't centered around a meal. It's not the type of thing that people come and then spend an extended amount of time and have a multi-course meal. It's really, the way we're structuring it is, you know, a little bit of a difference to the pop-up format, in that it's more so, I guess, mirrors like a CSA model, where somebody's just coming and you know, we'll make a connection with them there face-to-face, but there's an opportunity to pre-order the product online and then just come and you know, grab your order and go. So it is a pop-up in that we don't have a fixed location, and I'll definitely, you know, address that as part of your question as far as the planning goes. Finding the place to do it was certainly a challenge. You know, nothing is ever you know, perfect. You always have to make some accommodations in a space. Maybe the oven isn't big enough, maybe there's not enough frozen storage space, or whatever it is. So you kind of learn to make accommodations to fit into the right place. So that was a big, you know, component. And then just even the preparations leading up to it, having the storage space outside of where the pop-ups are, you know, giving us an ample amount of time to be able to promote the event, and kind of putting all of those factors in together as it's coming together, was certainly a challenge.
Mm-hmm. So where are you doing the event?
So we have two spots that we're doing it. The first spot is, and all this stuff is on our website, on the topnoshpdx.com. We're doing it on Saturday at the new Book Bar, which is on Fremont and about 13th. And then Sunday, we're doing it down at the old Mother's location, now the Velvet Lounge, on 2nd and Harvey Milk, 2nd and Stark. So we're excited about both locations. We're really also, you know, to your earlier question about the planning, should we do it for 2 days? Should we just do it for 1 day? You know, I mean, and in one, you know, respect, you know, everything's 15 minutes away in this town, regardless of what side you're on, but we still wanted to kind of cater to folks on the east side and folks on the west side and make it as convenient as possible. And we think we landed on two really great spots that are very accessible and make it easy. But, you know, when you're looking for a space, you're trying to look for something that is a win-win scenario and a win-win situation, not only for you, but for the space itself.
Cool. Uri, why don't you tell us a little bit about your culinary background? Like, did you come to this as a chef working at restaurants, or like a home chef?
I've been in the restaurant game for going on almost 3 decades now. You know, I am a proud graduate of the Western Culinary Institute, back when it was just the Western Culinary Institute here in town. I started a restaurant on the east side called Jam on Hawthorne, and was very fortunate to pass that along to people that have taken good care of it since then. Since then, I've worked also at the Small Business Development Center here in town, helping folks get various food projects off the ground with a program called Getting Your Recipe to Market. And I learned a lot by learning alongside other people in that program about what it takes to launch a food business, whether it be a packaged food business, a restaurant business, a catering business, etc. And now I also own and operate a couple of ice cream shops in town called Dairy Hill Ice Cream, one in Hillsdale and a new spot down in the Pioneer Place Mall. So I've come at it, you know, from you know, several different angles in the, you know, I would never call myself a chef, you know, yet the, you know, after hearing other people speak today, they're, you know, they're the real chefs, the ones that, you know, are breaking a sweat and, you know, cutting their hands, you know, 60 hours plus hours a week in the kitchen. I'm more of a food business operator. But with this particular project and with Top Notch, it is something that I've had on my mind for several years. And with the encouragement of my partner, Farah, it's something that we're just going for. And we're just going to, you know, to really tie it back into the theme of today's program and pop-ups, the format of the pop-up is giving us an opportunity to validate a concept. You know, is this something worthwhile? Before, like to your earlier questions about the investment level and everything that people do to start a restaurant, a pop-up is a gentle introduction to say, like, hey, are we on to something or not? You know, we're basically, through this format, we're able to kind of extend an invitation to the community to be like, hey, come check us out, and then you'll be able to say that you got in on this in the early stages. You remember when it was just a pop-up.
And are you hoping eventually that this will turn into a brick and mortar?
We'll see. I mean, you know, I mean, you have big dreams. You know, sometimes an idea turning into a brick and mortar is actually the worst thing that could happen to the idea. So you kind of have to just take it, you know, take it slow. Is a, you know, and even like define, you know, maybe it becomes a you know, more of a full-fledged, you know, catering company. I mean, what we're hoping to do is, as we do a series of pop-ups, gradually introduce more products and then judge the reaction that we get to the products that we're introducing. You know, for now it's, you know, I mean, it's amazing as we're just going around tasting things out to people in the community. How many people have never had whitefish salad before? Like, whitefish salad, I mean, I think I've probably had that before mother's milk. I mean, whitefish salad was, you know, so but to hear, you know, people taste it for the first time and see their eyes light up and be like, oh, that's not tuna, that's white, you know, so things like that. It's exciting to turn people onto that, and then to have, like, you know, a coworker of my business partner Farah's was saying that her husband tasted one of our bagels, and, you know, he's been out of New York since the 70s, and this is the best bagel he's had in 30 plus years. So both the combination of turning people on to new tastes that they've never been exposed to before, and kind of evoking these, you know, very emotional reactions that they get to kind of the old world tastes, where that takes us, whether it's a brick and mortar or just you know, more custom personalized catering centered around these things, it'll be exciting to see.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for sharing with
you
us.
You bet, Woody. My pleasure.
So topnotchpdx.com.
Top Notch, N-O-S-H. Yes. So it's, yeah, but like I say, Farah's family comes from a business that was called Top Notch back in Long Island. And so we are in tribute to that, calling it Top Notch, N-O-S-H, pdx.com.
Thanks. Awesome. Thanks so much. Now we're going to turn to Sakile Mitchell.
Hello.
She runs Brown Sugar Cookie Company and Catering, where she is the cookie queen, mm-hmm. which I love. and she also recently started hosting pop-up dinners under the name Brown Sugar Bistro. Thanks mm-hmm. so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So you make cookies.
I do.
What made you want to start making vegan soul food?
Well, I was actually looking for a way to make what I already eat every day a little bit healthier. And it was kind of like a New Year's Eve type of resolution. Like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to have a better diet. And what better way to do that than to have my pop-up vegan food? That way I'm forced to, like, do recipe development with vegan food and actually make that and sell that to people. And so far, it's been pretty amazing.
You just had your first pop-up and you sold out.
I did. 60 so people.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Tell us what you learned. Tell us what the experience was like.
Man. Okay. Well, for the most part, it was pretty great. There were, of course, like, some bumps, like every single restaurant that you can go to. I think what was amazing were people's openness to the different types of food that I made. And also their patience and their feedback was incredible for me. I think what I learned is never do a service back to back with only an hour in between.
that is something I've learned as well.
I will never do that again. That was incredibly like hard to switch over, clean everything, switch over, and just go to the next set of people. So now in April, I have 3 different services on 3 different dates because I'm not doing it back to back again. But yeah, that's pretty much what I learned. Yeah.
Awesome.
Had you ever cooked at a restaurant before or like done that kind of like full dinner thing?
Yeah, I've been cooking in restaurants for like 7 years now. So I have had that restaurant experience going into it. I wouldn't have done it without it. And so, yeah, I've been working in different restaurants around Portland for over 7 years, all different types. My first job was at Chipotle, and then Living Room Theaters. I worked at Virginia Cafe, and I was a sous chef at Akati PDX, which is an amazing West African restaurant on Fremont. And yeah, so I've been doing this for a while.
So your pop-up's in a restaurant while mm-hmm. it's closed, which mm-hmm. I think is awesome. I think it's really cool that pop-ups are popping up in places that are already restaurants, but that, you know, it might be like a kind of more underutilized space. So how did you find that location and what was it like to find it?
I was actually, so the owner, Jenny, who is amazing, she owns Suzette's on Belmont. She actually approached me about the idea. I had met her through a farmer's market that we were right next to each other on. And then we later became Facebook friends and just started communicating. So when I expressed interest in starting a pop-up, she's like, "Do you need a space?" I'm like, "Yes." And so it just kind of worked out that way.
That's really cool. So I think we've been asking everybody about it. What do you do for labor? Like, do you have people who already work for you working with you, or is it just you? How's it work out?
It's mainly just me. But I've been working with people for so long that it's awesome that I get to, call on the people that I've worked with before that I know that I work well with to come and help me. So this last time I had somebody that I used to work with in a bakery, and she actually has done some line cooking before, and she came and helped. And I had an awesome bartender, Elizabeth, who was helping that day. And actually, my mom, my mom, like, she jumped in. We fell a bit behind, and she actually like got up from the table and just jumped in. "What do you need? What can I do?" She started like serving. She started so bussing. Sweet. I was like, "Mom, you're awesome." So it's mostly friends, family, and people that I know that I can work well with.
That makes sense. Big question for you. How do you get people to come to your pop-up? How do you sell the tickets?
Lots of social media, lots of networking with people, letting them know wherever I go. It's like I'm talking to somebody. It could be like they're a tax person. I'm like, "What do you do in the middle of the day when you're hungry? Like, do you like soul food? I make vegan soul food. I have a pop-up. Do you want to come?" And so just like bringing that up whenever I can. And also I have amazing friends who share everything that I do on social media as well. And people like YGB, Mercatus. I've been working with Prosper Portland for a long time because they created My People's Market, which is the first ever market that I was at as the cookie queen. And so they've been amazing with like sharing what I do. And yeah, it's good to have a community of people who are entrepreneurs who will share what you do. Yeah,
definitely. Absolutely. And when is your next pop-up?
So I have three in April. I have one on the 16th, the 23rd, and the 30th.
And where can folks get tickets?
You can find them on www.brownsugarcookiecompany.com/brown-sugar-bistro.
Awesome. Sekile, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to take another quick break, and then we're going to switch to talking about gardens.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Springtime.
Welcome to the Food Show. We're talking today about not just pop-up restaurants, but other things that are popping up around town, like flowers, and what we should be doing in our gardens. Marisha Auerbach is here. She's our resident garden and permaculture expert. And we're going to talk about gardening. Marisha, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
It's been so sunny and beautiful this week, and I want to just start planting everything right now. But is it too early to start?
It's too early for some things. Our weather is unseasonably warm this week. I mean, it could almost be all right to leave tomatoes outside, but don't do it. They're going to get cold. The warm season crops really want us to have 50 degrees nighttime temperatures. And on average, our last frost can be as late as April 15th, but about 50% of the time, our last frost is March 23rd. So, you know, we got a doozy of the weather back in late February, early March that really surprised a lot of people with the cold. And then it snapped from cold weather right over to warm weather really quickly. So it's important to not get too excited, but there's still some stuff that can go in the ground right now. It's a great time to plant peas and onions. All perennials are ideally planted now. If anyone's thinking about planting fruit trees, this is the best time. Usually we're getting lots of rain, and so it's really easy to transplant perennials, but not so much this year. So give that extra water, and then we can transplant lettuces and brassicas like the broccolis and cabbages, as well as all root crops can be direct sown in the garden now.
How do you know what is the best time for planting?
The best time for planting is really told by the nighttime air temperatures and the soil temperatures. So right now, we've been on like around 42 to 45 degrees at night. So that's a really good time for these cool season crops. Once I'll start watching the thermometer to see when we get to that 50 degree reliable nighttime low. And then it's a good time to start putting in tomatoes and peppers, and eggplants prefer 60 degrees.
Fun.
So for me, the right time to plant is often like technically when I'm out of town. Like the right time to plant is never when I actually can do it. So is it better to just like get stuff in the ground now and hope that it's okay, or should I wait?
You know, if you're doing it by seed, you get a lot of seeds in a seed packet. So I think it's worth trying. I planted my peas before I went out of the country in the beginning of February, and I'm going to plant them again tomorrow. So, you know, it depends on how much of an investment you're making.
What's the thing with peas? You soak them ahead of time or something?
Yeah, I soak them for 2 days. I'll put them in warm water and then drain it in the morning, and then fill it with warm water again, and then drain it in the evening, and then fill up with warm water, and then drain the following morning, and then fill up again and drain it.
So it's like you're making sprouts.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and you want to see those peas swell, and then you know that they're viable and ready to go. And then it's best to coat them in legume inoculant. And that's a powder that contains the bacteria that have the symbiotic relationship with the peas, the nitrogen-fixing bacteria. So then you have added nitrogen in your garden, and you also have the peas growing extra well because because they have their symbiotics.
I had no idea.
What should I be doing right now to get my garden beds ready?
Well, if you need a soil test, now's a great time to do that. Then you can tell if the pH of your soil is where you want it or what amendments you'd need to add for the crops that you want to grow. I recommend A&L Labs in Tigard for soil testing. If you know what your pH is, generally we need to add a little bit of lime after the winter to sweeten our soil to make it less acidic. And then top dressing with compost really helps. And as this year has been unseasonably dry at times, especially right now, compost is really important for being able to enhance the water storage capacity of our soil so that we can have more water retention, water less, in case we get one of those really dry summers that we've had the last couple of years.
Do you have any tips on low-cost ways to add things, amendments to your soil, like lime and compost, like places to get it that are...
Well, lime can also be substituted by wood ash. So if you can get clean wood ashes, so that means no... you know, weird wood like pressure treated wood or anything that's been like had shellac or anything on it or any glossy paper. Also, just composting yourself not only is the cheapest way to do it, but it also ensures that you have things that aren't contaminated. And I go to Naomi's and Powell. I think Naomi's is always the best quality materials. And when you're looking at what you're putting in your soil, which is going to be what you're putting in your body when you're growing edibles, I don't really want to compromise with something that is that I might be skeptical about. So she always has the best quality materials.
Awesome. So should we also be starting seeds indoors right now?
Yeah, if you're set up for starting seeds indoors, then now's a great time to do that. What I mean by set up for starting seeds is that a lot of the seeds that we start indoors to get an advance on the season are things that grow in the tropics. So we want to be able to mimic the tropical conditions. And so what I do is I start my seeds on a heat mat with the lights off. And then once they germinate, I turn the lights on. And I want my lights to be on 12-hour cycles, just like it is in the tropics. And then I want to monitor my indoor temperatures as well as the soil temperatures to make sure I'm mimicking that condition in the tropics.
Whoa, that sounds hard. I always try to start seeds and I just like put them in some soil in the window and then my cat destroys it or it's just not the right kind of light. So are there any seeds that you can start inside where you don't need any like special lights or anything like that, or are you just better off sowing directly?
Seeds need light to grow, and so you might be able to start things indoors for the controlled environment, but then once you start noticing your plants have come up, what usually happens when you do them in the window is that they start getting leggy. That means that they're reaching towards your window, towards the light. So at that point, you could move them outside, and that might make it easier. Yeah, and then some things like, you know, lettuces or any of the cold-tolerant greens, you could just start outside instead of just doing it in your house.
Awesome. Yeah. So, Marisha, I think you have some events coming up. Do you want to tell us about those?
Sure, I do. I have a Vegetable Start CSA, which takes the guesswork out of what to plant each month. My subscribers get one flat of vegetable starts every month, and the deadline to sign up for that is April 1st. I also have other plant packages if someone wants to grow edible flowers or meet their goals for producing salsa. We also have our online permaculture design course is coming up through Oregon State University. That starts April 1st. We're also going to be running a course on advanced permaculture skills for climate resilience this semester. And then I do my once a month workshop series at People's Food Co-op on what to do now in the garden. And the next class is on Tuesday, April 9th. And all of that can be found on my website at permaculturerising.com.
Permaculturerising.com. Thank you so much, Marisha.
Yes,
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All right, we've been talking about pop-ups all day, so I'm going to tell you all where to go to have some fun at some of these pop-ups. This coming Monday, March 26th at 6 p.m., is the annual Vegan Macdown, where multiple restaurants will compete to see who has the best mac and cheese. This event will be held at Lagunitas Community Room at 237 Northeast Broadway Street. And if you love olives, you definitely got to check out Olive You Long Time, a four-plate dinner experience. Everything is, of course, made with olives, and this is going to take place on March 27th at 7:30 p.m. at Botanist Bar PDX, 1300 Northwest Lovejoy Street. And then on March 29th, Mildred Winters is popping up with her Southern Feast Dinner Series. Dinner starts at 6 p.m. and will be held at Fika, which is located at 4120 North Williams. And we will have this information up on the website, so please do check back on the website.
And Tal, are you participating in that vegan MacDown?
I may be, yes.
What are you making?
It's possible.
Is it a secret?
I think we're going to make some mac and cheese.
What style?
We're going to make a Middle Eastern mac and cheese, yeah. Something spicy, something with harif.
That sounds delicious.
It's going to be interesting.
Excellent. Well, that's it for this episode of The Food Show. If you have any comments about the show or ideas for future shows, please email us at foodshow@kbu.fm. And if you missed any of the show or you want to find links to our guest events, you can find the episode at kbu.fm, or you can download the podcast in the iTunes or Google Play stores.
And please, if you're having a pop-up, if you're having any event that you want us to promote, please email us.
That's foodshow@kbu.org. So stay with KBU this afternoon. We're going to be hearing from Jazz Lives. We want to thank all of our guests for being on today's show and our engineer, Heather. And don't forget to stay tuned again for The Food Show next month on the third Wednesday of April. Until then, I'm Emily Becker.
And Tal Caspi.
Thanks for listening.
I made you a present you never expected. It's hard to take risks.
KBOO is looking for a grant writer to join our team. We are seeking someone with a proven track record in writing successful, complex proposals for diverse sources of grant funding. previous experience working in the philanthropic landscape of the Portland metro area is preferred, and previous experiences working with community media organizations and with communities of color are A+. This is a 1-year contract position for a total of 200 hours at $25 an hour, and the grant writer will work closely with the KBOO development director. For more information, go to our website at kboo.fm and click on the KBOO is hiring link on the right side of the home page.
Last night, I dreamt I went to Mandalay again.
Coming to the Monday Sampler,
I stood by the iron gate,
an all-star presentation of the classic gothic mystery Rebecca.
Oh, yes, she was the beautiful Rebecca Hildreth, you know, the most glamorous creature in all England.
Adapted from the best-selling novel by Daphne du Maurier. Featuring Ida Lupino.
Nothing was covered up.
Oh, Judith Anderson.
The most beautiful room you've ever seen.
And Ronald Coleman.
Please, don't call me Mr. De Winter. I have a very impressive array of first names. George, Fortescue, Maximilian.
Tune in Monday, March 25th at 2 p.m. as the Monday Sampler presents.
Do you believe the dead come back and watch the living? No, no, I don't believe it.
Rebecca.
Good afternoon and welcome to KBOO 90.7 FM, The Boo, and you are now tuned to Jazz Lives. And we're going to start off with something that maybe someone is having for lunch today. They say it's a good time to have this if you're having it and not at night. So here we go. Marcia here with you for 2 hours on The Boo with Jazz.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Wednesday, March 20th, 2019. Nearly 40,000 University of California workers walked off the job today at campuses and medical centers around the state. According to the Sacramento Bee, the union representing 14,000 research, technical, and healthcare workers, UPTA CWA,